that because they had departed from him, he was going to take away their men of skill, take away their men of knowledge, take away their great orators, take away their craftsmen, and take away their men of valor. The cream of their society, those who generated the wealth, created progress, they would be gone. And this is particularly a problem for Israel of old, because you'll read where in the days of Solomon, that country became enormously wealthy. And you have to ask why. The money didn't just grow on trees. Of course, we know ultimately the answer is because the Lord blessed them. But that raises the question, how? How did they accumulate so much wealth that we would be told that silver was of no account? You see, it was in such abundance. Well, my speculation would be that part of that may have been generated through agriculture. When you live over in a part of the world where most people are in the middle of a sandbox, you're going to be in a very advantageous position if you can produce food. Of course, the Jews should have taken into account the fact that you can't produce food unless God sends down the rain from heaven. But I suspect that a lot of that wealth was generated through what they call human capital. They had people with skills and knowledge that other people didn't have. And when you have the skill and you have the knowledge, very soon you're going to have the wealth. Back when I was in school studying economics, maybe some of y'all had to study the same things I did. They'll talk about Adam Smith and the great contributions that he made to the field of economics, and how that before Adam Smith, the world was obsessed with a doctrine called mercantilism. And under the doctrine of mercantilism, you measured wealth by how much gold or silver you had. So this was the obsession of the countries of the world then, the French, the British, the Spanish. Let's get all the gold and silver we can. But Smith said that there's another form of wealth that could be far greater, and that is when you have knowledge or skills that other people don't have. If you have that, soon you'll have their gold and silver too. And now we can see that's true. South Africa's got more gold or silver than anybody in the world. But a lot of you don't even know where it is, you see. So Israel had been blessed with very knowledgeable people that God said he would take away. And now look at America. This is what has made our country great from a natural material standpoint, that God has blessed us with genius after genius, inventor after inventor. What would things look like now if Thomas Edison or Alexander Graham Bell or Nikola Tesla had been Germans or French and not Americans? What would happen if Einstein had stayed over there in Switzerland? What if Oppenheimer had been a Japanese? Then the big bomb might have got dropped on New York instead of Hiroshima. Or in more recent times, look at Apple Computer. That company is bigger than most countries in the world. That one company is far bigger than most countries in the world. So let's suppose that Steve Jobs had been Portuguese or Chinese. Where would we be then? But we have had one great mind after another that has come up in this country or came to this country. And if God were to take all that away, then where are you going to be? He took away men of valor. He told the Jews, I'll take those away. Where would we be without the great soldiers that we've had in the past, men who are largely vilified now by people who are totally out of touch with reality. They live in fantasy land. In this world, you got to fight wars. And if you want to fix that, then you better be praying that God will send Jesus Christ, because that's the only way it's going to get fixed. You know, Woodrow Wilson thought he was going to fix it. And he called World War I the war to end all wars. Now, I don't know how interested you are in history, but even if you're not, you ought to carefully study World War I. I'll tell you what World War I was. World War I, it's hard to say, isn't it? World War I was the war to start all wars. You study that out and you look at all the wars that have taken place in modern times, World War I was the war to start all wars. In fact, we're still fighting wars that started in World War I. So where are we going to be without soldiers? And this is what God said to Israel. These things I will take away. That would be the death knell for any nation that was particularly threatening to Israel. Verse 8, for Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord to provoke the eyes of his glory. The show of their countenance doth witness against them. In other words, you can see it in their face. They declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Now that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Things people used to be ashamed of, now they're proud of. And if you don't approve of it, then you're a hater. You're a enemy to society. They declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they have rewarded evil unto themselves. Say ye to the righteous that it should be well with him, for they shall eat of the fruit of their doings. Woe unto the wicked, it should be ill with him, for the reward of his hands shall be given unto him. Now that first verse, the first promise, ought to be very important to us. You know, we see this wickedness in our world and we wonder what's going to happen to us. Well, Isaiah said, what's going to happen to you? It will be well with you. That's what will happen. And when I read all that, I think very much about 2 Peter chapter 2, which incidentally is highly correlated with the book of Jude. But in 2 Peter chapter 2, he talks about how that in the flood, when God destroyed the whole planet, still, he delivered the righteous. And then when God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, once again, he delivered the righteous. And then he ends with this conclusion. Verse 9, 2 Peter chapter 2, the Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. Isaiah said, tell the righteous, it'll be well with you. You don't need to be popping Valiums because of what you can see is going to happen. Do you think that God is incapable of taking care of his people? If so, you don't have much faith and you haven't read the Bible. He's taken care of them all along. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err and destroy the way of thy paths. When you study the history of Israel, that's an exact summary on what would happen. When the leadership was bad, the people went bad. When the leadership went good, typically the people went well. You know, I would hate for my life to be characterized that way, that I was going to go whichever way that the leadership of this country took. We're supposed to be above that. Besides, we got good leadership always, right? Our leader is Jesus Christ. And the word of God. But with the Jews, they went whichever way the leadership went. And I'm afraid in this country, with the majority of people, that's the way it goes. They ignorantly, naively, foolishly follow the leaders of society. The Lord standeth up to plead and standeth to judge the people. The Lord will enter into judgment with the ancients of his people. The people are supposed to be wise, but who have become fools and led others into foolishness because people trusted in these ancients. God will judge these ancient people. And the princes, they too in a position of leadership. For ye have eaten up the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your house. What mean ye that beat my people to pieces and grind the faces of the poor, saith the Lord of hosts. Now I think that there no doubt was literally exploitation of poor people. Now, of course, we always hear that's happening in this country. And I never have been very sympathetic with those complaints. I made out my check to the IRS a few days ago, and let me tell you, I'm not wanting to hear right now about how much I've exploited other people. And I've been writing them big ones for a long time. But it has happened. It can happen. And in Israel, God repeatedly complained that poor people had been exploited. I'm sure they were exploited monetarily in matters of business, but I suspect another way that they were exploited is that the leadership took away the very thing that was most important to poor people, that added the most to the quality of their life, took away their religion. What's more precious than that? And of course, we're not poor folks here, but we're not filthy rich either. You know, I don't expect to be owning any condos on the beach or visiting the Taj Mahal. I'm glad I lead a comfortable life, but I'll have to tell you, my number one joy is right here. And I wouldn't have much use for life if it weren't for this. And when leadership does everything they can to corrupt it and prohibit it, then you have taken away from poor people the most precious thing that they have. All right, now, moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet, therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will discover their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet and their cauls and their round tires like the moon. Now, he's about to talk about a lot of things that women wear here, and at this point, I may not be qualified to preach. Maybe we should let a girl explain what a lot of these things are. But obviously what he's saying is that the beautiful ornaments that they had acquired during their prosperity, these things would be taken away. So when he talks here about bravery, that's an old word that could mean finery. The finery of their tinkling ornaments. Their cauls, that's an old word for hairnets. Their round tires, like the moon. This would be an ornament worn around a neck, like a necklace. And look at the shape of it. It's shaped like a crescent moon. Well, we have seen that shape, have we not? Evidently, that symbol has been around for a long time. And the chains and the bracelets, the mufflers, as I understand that to be their veils, their bonnets or hoods, ornaments of the legs, and the headbands and the tablets and the earrings. Tablets, I understand those to be perfume boxes. The rings and nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel, the mantles and the Wimples, which I understood to mean hood, crisping pins, which is a purse, the glasses, polished metals, and such that were worn as ornaments and mirrors, and the fine linen and the hoods and the veils. And it shall come to pass that instead of sweet smell, there should be a stink, and instead of a girdle, a rent, instead of a well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a stomacher, a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. Thy men shall fall by the sword, and thy mighty in the war, and her gates shall lament and mourn, and she, being desolate, shall sit upon the ground in grief. So these are threats of coming invasion, in which many men would die at the sword, and then women would be left as widows, or the women would so thoroughly outnumber men, many women would have no hope of ever being married or ever being married to a Jewish man. And now that brings us to the next chapter. And in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. So in the literal sense, the men have been killed. And the women, if they're to have any hope of a husband, must submit to polygamy. And they're in such desperation that they'll even tell the prospective groom, you don't have to feed me. You don't have to clothe me. Don't support me. Just call me your wife so it'll take away my reproach. Now, all that literally happened. But there is also a mystical or spiritual meaning to that text, and Christians have believed it for as long as there have been Christians. There's something in this that's allegorical, and what is to follow is definitely allegorical in meaning. So why not here? Seven women taking hold of one man and saying, let us wear your name. Call us your wives. You don't have to feed us. You don't have to support us. Let us just be called by your name so as to take away our reproach. We will eat our own bread. We will wear our own apparel. You know, in the Bible, bread is used as a symbol of doctrine. When Jesus told his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, you remember how they interpreted that. He's rebuking us because we forgot to put bread on the boat before we left. Of course, he corrected them. And he told them that by bread or leaven, he meant their doctrine, their teachings. Now, apparel. You know what apparel is used to represent in the Bible? Apparel is a representative of righteousness. And we hope to be clothed in garments of righteousness given to us by Jesus Christ. You remember in Matthew 22, the rogue guest at the wedding, what was wrong with him? He did not have on a wedding garment. He decided that he would wear his own clothes, whereas when you went to a wedding, you were supposed to wear what the king gave you to wear. So these women are saying, we want our own doctrine, and we'll wear our own righteousness, but let us be called by your name so as to take away our reproach. Now, that's a pretty good description of the pseudo-Christian world, isn't it? We don't care what the Bible says. We're going to make up our own doctrines. And those man-made doctrines invariably, to some degree or another, are investing too much confidence in human obedience, human decisions, human righteousness, We don't need your righteousness. We don't need your doctrine. We're going to have our own doctrine, and we'll wear our own righteousness, but let us be called Christians, because that has a good sound to it, you see. This verse has been interpreted for 2,000 years as having that as one of its meanings, and I'm satisfied there's probably truth in that. Now he continues, in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. Now, he's already told what's going to happen to the greater lot of them. They'll be in poverty. The men will be killed in such great numbers that women will be begging for men to practice polygamy and things like this. But for those who escape of this, he said, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful. Now, anyone reading through the book of Isaiah the first time and with no knowledge of the Bible would just be totally confused here. What in the world do you mean by the branch of the Lord? But this verse is introducing to the Bible a term, an expression that is going to be used many other times, and there is no doubt that it is used as a description of Jesus Christ. And here is, insofar as I know, is the first place in the Bible where he's described as the branch, and by first I mean first chronologically in the Bible. Now I want to read to you some of these other verses in the Bible where he's described as the branch. One of these will be in Isaiah himself, just a few chapters later, chapter 11, verse 1. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, that would be David's father, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of the knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. All Christians agree. That's talking about Jesus Christ. Now we go to Isaiah 14, where he's talking about the man of sin, or what the world calls Antichrist. There he says he's cast, or will be cast, out of his grave like an abominable branch. What sense does that make? What do you mean, cast out of his grave like an abominable branch? Well, because what we read earlier, we can make sense of this. Jesus Christ, the glorious branch, he was cast out of his grave too in a resurrected, glorified, eternal body. But the man of sin will be vomited up out of his grave. This one would-be branch, this imitator of Jesus Christ, he will have no resurrection of the righteous, but will be vomited up out of his grave. All right, now let's move to Jeremiah 23, verse 5. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. And this is his name, whereby he shall be called the Lord our righteousness. Again, Jeremiah 33:15. In those days and at that time, I will cause the branch of righteousness to grow up unto David, and he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land. Now a few more, two more. That one was Jeremiah 33:15. Now we go to Zechariah 3:8. Zechariah 3:8. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. Now, Zechariah had just seen a vision, and God is telling Zechariah, the men you saw in this vision, they're wonders. They represent things. They represent higher things. Behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I've laid before Joshua upon one stone should be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the gravings thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. So here he's referred to Christ as a branch. And he's also described him as a plumb bob stone. That if you want to get things perfectly up and down, you have to get a string with a stone on the end of it. That's called a plumb bob. And that's what a carpenter would use in that instance. Now, God is saying that when he brings Jesus Christ, he's going to be a plumb bob stone with eyes all the way around. In other words, this stone gets everything exactly right. It's got seven eyes in it. This stone here has no error in it whatsoever. But he called him the branch. And that's my point now. This name that Zechariah uses was introduced by Isaiah in the verse that we're considering. Now, one more verse, Zechariah chapter 6, verse 12. And speak unto him, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, behold, the man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. So in Zechariah's day, they were building a rock house. God was prophesying through Zechariah that one of these days, there's going to be a man called the branch. He's going to build God's real house, and it's not going to be made of rocks. It'll be a spiritual house of which this man, called the branch, will be the cornerstone, and the apostles will be the foundation stones. Me and you will be bricks in the walls. And then the last stone, the headstone, that'll be Jesus Christ too. Now you may ask, well, why didn't Isaiah just come out and plainly state that? Why didn't he explain what this branch means? Why is the Bible so hard? Well, I'll tell you, it's hard because God intended for it to be hard. That's why it's hard. If you want to crack it open, take a look at it, say, I give up, then you'll get nowhere. If you want to scoff at it, then you may be doing exactly what God planned for a lot of people to do. It's hard because God intended for it to be hard. But it's also designed where there is great reward to a person who will invest themselves in it and persevere in its study. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious to these who are escaped. A lot of what Isaiah is talking about would take place in the times of Jesus Christ, where the vast greater part of the Jewish people were destroyed by the Romans, dispersed all over the world. They went through some of the saddest times in all their history. But while they were in great sadness, here was a handful of Jews over here who were happier than any people had ever been in the history of the world. They were believers in Jesus Christ. They were believers in salvation. And those Jews would do more to change the world than I suppose any people who ever lived in the world. I mean, these were people like Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, who in their writings expressed their great joy. Joy unspeakable and full of glory. Isaiah, 800 years before, those men prophesied of them here. While the other Jews are in misery and under the judgment of God, there'll be some who will be rejoicing because the branch of the Lord, or Jesus Christ, will be beautiful and glorious to them. And the fruit of the earth should be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. And I really think when he talks about the fruit of the earth, he's still talking about Jesus Christ. I know he came down from heaven, but the wonder of Jesus is that he was born of a woman, formed of the elements of this earth. The most beautiful fruit this earth has ever produced in Jesus Christ. And you know, Isaiah said of him, he hath no form nor comeliness. And when we shall see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. That's in Isaiah 53. But to a Christian, there is nothing any more beautiful than Jesus Christ. And that's what Isaiah is saying. Now let's move rapidly. And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy. Now he's talking about the heavenly Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem. He that is left, that has not been destroyed in the conflagration that takes the entire earth. Even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. And that could be translated, everyone that's written to life, in the book of life. It's going to be a sad story for those who aren't. But for those who are written in the book of the living, or written in the book of life, there's a glorious day ahead. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. Now, these people who are rejoicing, who are saved, they had to be washed. Now when he talks about God washing away the filth, he's not talking about the filth of these people who will undergo eternal condemnation. But he's talking about the filth of these who see the branch of the Lord as being beautiful and glorious. He's washed their filth away. And shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. And the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and a shining, a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from the storm and from rain. So we're done with this chapter. He has said that in this glorious day, that there's going to be a cloud and a pillar of fire as a defense over God's people. Now here he's referring or alluding back to what happened when the children of Israel came out of Egypt. They were wandered about the wilderness. Well, you couldn't hurt them because God protected them with a cloud and a pillar of fire. Well, he said the new Jerusalem or the heavenly Jerusalem will be the same way. I don't know that literally there'll be one there. I'll be fine with it if there is. But what he's saying is there is no way you can hurt these people. No way you can hurt God's heavenly people because his hand is over them, defending them forever. That's a beautiful thought, isn't it? And then he said, moreover, there'll be a tabernacle there for them to give them protection and refuge from the rain and the heat. Well, I'm not expecting a literal animal skin tabernacle. That's more allegorical language. Now, what is that tabernacle? Go over to Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set up on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. That true tabernacle is Jesus Christ, especially his body. And there in Hebrews 8 and 9, the Apostle Paul is going to deal with that subject thoroughly. In heaven, we have a refuge. We have a place of protection. We'll be protected there forever. You know, heaven is not a secure place simply because the doors only swing one way. The reason it's a secure place is because Jesus is there. And that's what Isaiah is talking about. Our tabernacle, which is a place where we can go when the rain is falling and the hailstones are falling and the heat is pressing down. If you're a believer in these things and a believer in Jesus, but have not been united with his church, this is the right night to do it. So